Welcome back, everyone, to Commerce Experience. I'm your host, Brian Walker, Chief Strategy Officer at Bloomreach. Today, we're talking about fulfillment and logistics. It's central to every aspect of e-commerce customer experience and the heart of every e-commerce team's operations and services organization, making it vital to ensure that it's done right. Without fulfillment, there essentially is no customer experience and no product on the consumer doorstep. So today we're going to explore both domestic and international fulfillment with our guest, Brittany Smith. Brittany is the CFO at ShipBob, an international tech company based in Chicago that helps D2C e-commerce brands be successful and scale their fulfillment experience. I also think Brittany is our first CFO on the podcast, so I'm looking forward to asking her perspective on that as well. Brittany made the jump from private equity over to the corporate world about 7 years ago and has worked with both small and large companies throughout that time. Throughout the episode, we talk about what brands should look for in a fulfillment partner, key cost drivers leaders should consider in scaling their fulfillment and logistics operations, and how fulfillment impacts the end-to-end customer experience and what the shift back to retail means for e-commerce brands. Enjoy the show. Brittany, wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for your time.
Happy to be here. Look forward to chatting.
So we're going to start, Brittany, with the first question we ask every guest on the podcast. What was your first job or role that dealt with e-commerce or digital?
Yeah, good question. I really started my career in the late 90s, early 2000s. So even when I joined my first company, they gave me a pager, which is kind of funny to think of. And that was considered digital back then. And I started in private equity, so investing in companies. And candidly, a lot of them were trying to figure out what is digital, what is e-commerce. So that was really my first exposure to it, which is really from that business perspective of how do I commercialize this? What is it? How are consumers going to use it?
Wow, that's great. Now, ShipBob primarily partners with merchants and third-party logistics providers, or otherwise known as 3PLs. What, in your mind, should e-commerce brands be looking for when they look at a potential fulfillment partner? We haven't talked about that a lot on the podcast, and I think it's a great opportunity to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a great question because there's lots of options out there. ShipBob falls into the tech-enabled space. And so we have software that is a merchant application as well as a warehouse management system. So the merchants are interacting with our merchant application, whereas our ShipBob fulfillment network, the 3PLs we partner with, are working with our warehouse management system. And we think technology is really important, but in our conversations with merchants, it's really focused on that level of quality and care that they're going to receive. So what is the 3PL's performance in terms of SLAs, in terms of really delivering to their consumers? Because that's ultimately how they grow their business and retain the consumers who love their brands. Our business was founded because our founders had an e-commerce business and it was fairly small and they couldn't find any 3PLs who were willing to work with them. They talked to 3PLs who needed to have 100,000 orders and didn't want to talk to them when they had 100 orders. And so that's a beauty also of our model is we can work small, we can scale. So really finding a partner who can provide, again, that level of care for you, maybe regardless of your size. Also, what are the capabilities and what do you want to do with your business? Is it focused on US only? Are you interested in international? Do you think you'll be able to grow your business only through e-commerce? Will you have to go to retail potentially? And then also pricing is obviously a factor as well as you think about the quality. And that's one of the things I think in this industry that we also try to do differently, which is a lot of transparency. So you often see hidden fees or additional fees for different services that you're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I worked at Amazon at a certain point in time. And when I worked there, if you took a job, you know, in corporate, you still had to do a stint at the fulfillment center as a part of your onboarding, which was pretty cool. I went to Kansas. shout out to Kansas. And, you know, it was really a great experience to see, you know, at the time, I would say Amazon was amongst the leaders in automation, but it was still fairly early, I think, even for Amazon in that journey. But what I think is kind of interesting and why I bring it up is because fulfillment for every other business in the direct-to-consumer space at the time, I'm talking about catalog companies, as well as e-commerce, viewed fulfillment as obviously just a cost of doing business. And the objective was really to reduce cost as much as possible, not use it as a differentiator or use it as a way to optimize the customer experience, if you will, along that line, along that approach to differentiation. And obviously, fast forward probably a little over 20 years now, you know, you realize that many organizations have to view this quite differently. And it does put a lot of pressure on small and larger businesses alike to kind of keep up with the customer experience. And I'm just curious, from your vantage point at ShipBob, and as you work with merchants, how they look at all of that. On the one hand, obviously have to look at reducing and managing costs. But on the other hand, recognizing this is, I think an arms race is probably the wrong analogy, because it's not necessarily a war, but nonetheless, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I know that's one of the things we do sell against, is that as exciting for your customer to get a brown box, or is it more exciting to get a custom box with special inserts inside that might be promoting other products they may like, or just develop that bond with the brand, special tissue paper, special ribbons, whatever it may be. And so we do think, especially for our brands, because we are working with more of those unique D2C brands that really are selling, I think, a unique value proposition and differentiated product to the consumer. And so the unboxing experience is really important. And so we've built our product roadmap really around more customization, because we think that's going to be more important versus more brown boxes. People want a pink box every once in a while and something exciting that comes through the mail. And we want to be able to deliver that and really differentiate that for our merchants.
Yeah, that makes sense. When you're looking at fulfillment partners, let's just assume for a moment, you know, looking at it from someone who's leading an e-commerce or direct-to-consumer business, and they're looking at potential partnerships, are there red flags that they should absolutely keep an eye out for?
Yeah, I think you see that even when you're going through the RFP or the partner selection process of how are you treated by the company during that? Are they transparent? Are they upfront about the services and capabilities that they have? You know, the last thing we want is somebody to join the ShipBob network and say, you sold me X and you can't do it. We try to be very clear and open with our merchants for when they come on. Pricing, as I mentioned, that can often be very opaque in the industry where it's cost plus. And what does that mean, right? Does it take 30 minutes to do it? Does it take 60 minutes to do it? And so that's why we try to price most things on a per order or per capability basis. And then really understanding who then is taking care of me as I evolve from the sales process to be an existing merchant, and what's that care support.
When you say care and support, what are the kinds of things that are likely to come up that you need care and support for, like on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis?
You know, these businesses are often evolving, so there could be different products that they're wanting to package together, right? So A and B are going really nice. I'm now going to have that as a SKU on my website instead of having them separate. Or I want to run a special promotion, or some of our merchants go on Good Morning America or the Today Show. And so there's, you know, an uplift there where they really need us to be able to fulfill, you know, a high quantity of orders right away. Or, you know, our merchant base has changed and we have more orders in the Northeast, so we need to distribute our inventory in different ways. So you do really, it's a really a high touch business going forward. And it makes sense just given how critical it is in terms of when you think about the life cycle of a merchant, this is actually how the consumer gets the good and making sure that's a great experience. And so we've built out care teams who really, I think, are best in the industry to be able to provide that support and be available to our merchants, because for our merchants, this is their business, this is their livelihood, you know, and making sure that we're really delivering for them is so important for us.
And if you're using a 3PL, you can't walk out the back door into your warehouse and figure it out, right? You're going to have to reach somebody, work through a problem. They're your eyes and ears. How is it working? What's practical, et cetera. So yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So that care piece is really, really important.
Other red flags?
I would say also, can a 3PL grow with your business? You know, I think that's one of the limitations we hear when we're talking to new merchants. I used to use, you know, a local 3PL, my business is bigger, it's expanded. You know, now they can't do retail fulfillment for me, or, you know, it's really expensive to now ship across the country, you know, right? My business has evolved to maybe more international. So those are some of the things also when you're thinking about who is the provider that we're going with, you know, if you're going with maybe a smaller regional provider versus somebody who could provide expanded capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, multinodal, in a sense, has become so important. And when I say multinodal, it basically means like lots of different fulfillment centers and places where inventory is staged. And that impacts the promised dates and so forth that you can offer the customer, like how quickly you can get the product to them. And it also can impact across the country your ability to service customers in a consistent way.
That's right. And 3PLs also have become really, I think, helpful to merchants given the supply chain challenges of how do you help them with their inventory management? You know, obviously that's been a huge point for the last 2 years, and it may continue for, you know, for an unforeseen period. And so how can the partner you're working with also help you with some of those bigger macro challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. You've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I guess my next question would be, you know, from a holistic perspective, you know, that could include employee allocation and capital allocation and investment. You know, what are some of the key cost drivers of operating a business with your own fulfillment center? And how does that compare when you talk about using an outsourced service provider plus technology provider to kind of service those same sort of set of needs? Because obviously a lot of businesses are still going to want to weigh control and management. Potentially this, the costs, they're not insignificant when you're working with a third-party services provider. It is a capital and labor-intensive set of processes. The costs get up there. I'm sure a lot of businesses try to look at, well, would it be more efficient to do it a different way? You know, you as a CFO, obviously, I think are uniquely positioned to kind of answer this question, which is, you know, how should businesses be thinking about that question when they compare sort of taking it in-house versus using third parties?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's a question we get often. I would say self-fulfillment by merchants is probably our biggest competitor. So that is probably 30 to 40% of the market is self-fulfilling. And you're right. Somebody started a business maybe in their basement, moved to their garage, and then they got so big that they opened up a fulfillment center of their own. And what we find is when we talk to merchants who have D2C businesses, they're often really, really good at product innovation, product development, the sales and marketing of it. And that's a different skill set than running an operations center or fulfillment. And so when you look at that time allocation, you brought up cost as well. That's often what we hear from our merchants, which is, where do I want to be making that investment? And if there are best in class,
and what do I want to be great at?
Right, exactly. And are there others who are great at things who I can leverage, right? And so you can't really outsource that product development, that marketing piece, but you can get best in class logistics capabilities that may be able to differentiate you from the competition who's maybe doing it in-house. And so that's why I think for this piece, because it is so complicated, you know, as I've gotten to know more and more about the industry during my time at ShipBob, it's really complicated to get that package into the hands of a consumer and get it done so that it's not damaged, it's not lost, that they have a good unboxing experience. And so really that does come down to what do they want to be good at? And I think we and others can provide great services and enable them to be really good at other things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, you have to focus on what you're going to be great at and what differentiates you. But of course, you need to also, you know, meet expectations and meet your promises to your customers in order to build a sustainable business. And those two things have to go together. But to your point, right, where what's really going to set you apart may not be the back office at the end of the day.
And we did launch a new product the middle of last year called Merchant Plus, where merchants who are running their own fulfillment centers can use ShipBob's technology. So instead of using one of our fulfillment centers, they can take our warehouse management system and put it into their own fulfillment center. And that's really received a lot of traction within the market because you're right. Some merchants just say, I want that control. I want that ownership. And so it's been interesting to see now that that product has been in market for a year, again, the success that we're seeing with merchant and also hybrid. They'll say, okay, well, I have a center in Las Vegas, but really I need, you know, additional capabilities on the East Coast. Maybe I'll use ShipBob on the East Coast. And so they may not want to have to make that capital investment again But again, we can provide them that hybrid experience. And again, the one dashboard from a merchant application to really run their business.
That makes sense. And obviously a lot of businesses are going to take inventory inbound from their offshore manufacturers or their vendors and so forth. And then there may be some packaging and or final assembly and things like that that are happening in their own facility. That's probably where they were fulfilling from originally. But then, you know, again, multinodal, they need to stage inventory closer to the consumer. They need to be able to respond to different spikes and all these kind of things. And they don't want to be dependent on shipping and logistics. Again, the supply chain and pandemic sort of taught us some of those challenges. And so using a third party to kind of stage inventory and fulfill from closer to the consumer, even though you may still have your own warehouse fulfilling a good, healthy portion of it, that just kind of makes sense as a business grows, right? So switching topics a little bit to international, I mean, you know, we've talked a little bit about that recently on the podcast, more from a tax and duties perspective. But what I'd love to understand from you is, what do businesses need to know as they think about fulfilling their international consumers' products, the logistics involved, and what are some of the considerations? Like, just keep in mind, like a domestic business looking to extend internationally, I guess, first and foremost.
Yeah, we've seen this both ways. We've seen U.S. merchants wanting to go abroad, so often to Canada, UK, Australia, so sticking more to the English-speaking countries as a first step, but then also merchants in those countries wanting to come to the U.S. And I think the big thing is really to try to partner with experts. You mentioned taxes and complexity. It can be very complex and can have, if it's not done right, have a really negative consumer experience where, you know, maybe a good is delivered and, oh gosh, there's a, you know, large tax bill you didn't know about that you need before you can actually get that good. So I think international markets are really attractive for the innovators out there. But again, it is really important, I think, to work with third parties, especially as you're setting up initially, to be able to get that expertise so you do it right and launch right in the countries.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when I'm fulfilling internationally, let's say from a domestic warehouse, a lot of that classification process and so forth is going to happen at the warehouse level. And I'm just kind of curious, like, are there any tips or insights in terms of how to do that in a most effective way, again, to minimize the impact on the consumer, but also minimize the cost? Because often if something's misclassified, you're going to be just paying a higher duty rate, or the consumer will be paying a higher duty rate than necessary. Like, are there any tips or tricks in terms of how to think about those parts of the process?
Yeah, well, you brought up a good point, which is if you want to start fulfilling internationally, you don't necessarily have to have goods in that country, right? You can certainly do it from here and send it abroad. And as you develop more of a consumer base, they're ultimately potentially having some inventory stored in market. But I think the biggest does have to get around the taxes and duties and just making sure that your consumer is aware of what those costs are up front, because I think that's the most negative experience is being surprised. And then also understanding the time to arrive. That's something we frequently hear about consumers, which is, I may not need it in 2 days, but I'd like to know when it's going to arrive. Don't tell me it's going to arrive in a week and then it takes 2 weeks to get there or a month to get there. So I think that's the other thing. And if you have the right partner, then the partner can certainly provide that information and that clarity to your consumer so that they have a great great experience with the good.
Yeah, your package isn't just lost in the international ether somewhere in between, right? Getting customs clearance or something, and visibility can be a challenge depending on the carrier and the shipping method and all of that. And it can be a frustrating consumer experience.
Absolutely. And that's one of the great things about ShipUp as a technology company, which is we are leveraging technology to make those decisions. And so we can help you optimize the decisions that you need so that you can find the lowest cost pricing for shipping or potentially the fastest, depending on what it is.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, many brands and e-commerce businesses are faced with sort of tightening up budgets and controlling spending amidst the the current economic situation. I don't even like calling it the era of uncertainty that I hear out there, because I think we have to be realistic and realize we've always lived in an era of uncertainty. But nonetheless, you know, there are some warning signs out there related to recession. Consumer confidence is at essentially an all-time low, even though consumers continue to spend on consumer goods at a fairly high rate. But inflation's taking a bite, and I think every business has to be somewhat pragmatic. As a CFO yourself, again, you know, how do you think businesses should be looking at sort of balancing cost optimization, customer experience, obviously potential for actual growth in this environment? Digital is, of course, still a primary way consumers are researching, discovering, and in times converting or deciding to go to even a physical store to convert. But how should CFOs be thinking about all of these factors, in your opinion, differentiating themselves without breaking the bank?
Yeah, it's a great question, especially in this environment where you're seeing lower levels of venture funding. So it's not as easy to raise capital as it was in the past. And so as a CFO, I do think it's prudent to be looking at actually every line item to say, do I need to have this cost? Is this the best way to be investing my capital? Also making sure that you are investing capital in the right areas. Sometimes things can just develop and grow, and then you take a step back and you say, wait a second, I'm, you know, not spending maybe enough on product development, or I'm not spending enough on research, or whatever it may be. So I do think in this environment as a CFO, you do want to be looking at each line item. That being said, I think ultimately what drives the health of your business is going to be the health of your consumers and your customers. And so how much do you really understand what's the cost to acquire those merchant or those customers? What's, you know, your retention of those customers? Do you have a really good business model, you know, where you're having a nice lifetime value being generated by those customers relative to what you're having to spend to acquire those customers? And that's where we've heard some challenges where obviously the customer acquisition costs, you know, through some of the well-known tech platforms have really increased. And then maybe you have a little bit lower LTV. And so that's created some challenges. But often that's really one of the biggest areas of spend is in that customer acquisition model. And do you have one that is sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're transitioning from sort of the era of acquisition to the era of retention. And in some respects, that might be a little oversimplified, but nonetheless, you know, there was a period of time where there was a tremendous amount of emphasis on customer acquisition through digital channels. And frankly, the math kind of worked, even if you're reacquiring a lot of the same customers through those channels, which was a little bit lazy, but nonetheless worked from a model perspective. Now with those costs, you know, quadrupling, if not more, that's really changed the equation. And you take into account the growth of the customer file during the pandemic and realize that, well, maybe your incremental lift through customer acquisition strategies is not what it once was, because you actually went through a period of significant file growth. Now the focus should really be on customer retention, the value you're bringing to your existing customers, making sure you're reactivating them through targeted, personalized communication and marketing and great product, hopefully, and then giving them a great experience that gets them back. And that's the actual business model. You know what I mean? And so I think we're kind of at that point. And I think it's a great CFO is going to look at all these questions very strategically with their business partners and not make just like cross the board 15% cuts or whatever that cut off the nose to spite the face, so to speak. You need to be very targeted and specific on how to drive the flywheel in the healthy way while trimming the things that are maybe not necessary or maybe were just some bloat or kind of led to that not particularly healthy business model, as you pointed
right.
out.
No, absolutely. And so, you know, you brought up a good point about customer retention and servicing. I mean, you know, you need to look all the way down, right? What's the gross profit? How much do I need to spend to service this customer? How much am I spending on my R&D to be able to develop the new products to retain or to acquire customers? So it is really trying to look holistically at the business. There's been a huge shift, as you mentioned, from growth really at any cost to wanting profitable growth. That's a huge theme that you're hearing from investors and seeing play out in the stock market. And that's you know, really true also for those who are private. But do you have a path to profitability and really often a path to break even? If can you demonstrate, again, that as you scale, that your business model sees leverage and that you will become a self-sustaining business going forward?
Yeah, I'm not the first one to say it by any means. I think this is a well tried and true. It's not, I wouldn't call it an insight because it's not necessarily, but it's like when you enter into this kind of a period economically, you end up going back to the fundamentals and you sort of reflect back on the 5 years previous and realize like that really didn't make sense, that we were only rewarding growth and that we were not really looking at the bottom line, and that companies that had extraordinary burn rates but had growth were being rewarded for that with high valuations and so on. Now it's more of a return to the fundamentals. And, you know, growth is still really important. It's one of the most important factors, but you have to have a path to sustainable business, which in a sense is profitability at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. I started my career focus on telecom and media companies. So that, you know, gives you a sense again of when I started, and it obviously switched to technology. But I've always been rooted back in that, you know, how much money does the business make, right? Like at the end of the day, you need to make money. And, you know, that's something investors obviously compare across industries, right? You know, how much free cash flow are you generating? So it is really important as a business. And again, as I mentioned, in this funding environment, I think it's even more important.
Well, speaking of growth, certainly the pandemic, everyone knows the story now, right? Drove, of course, a huge inflection point in e-commerce and direct-to-consumer business, which was fulfilled both through packages on the doorstep as well as curbside pickup and in-store and so forth. And now we are in this point where consumers in some ways are adapting back to some pre-pandemic behaviors, while at the same time, there's been some pretty fundamental shifts in our lifestyles with more people working remote, much fewer commutes than previously, even if they're doing a hybrid model. And that, of course, affects like how they get tasks done, how they fulfill errands and everything else in their lives, and of course, how they buy things and how they receive them. And I'm just kind of curious, as you work with your merchants and talk to them about this sort of next phase, hopefully post-pandemic, although many people are not sure it's really post-pandemic.
not over yet. We're still in it.
Most recent spike yet again. How are you, what are you hearing from your clients, your direct-to-consumer customers about what they're expecting and thinking about relative to digital versus physical retail, how these channels blend together? What are you hearing from them as they think through what's next? And obviously it's in context, can't not be with kind of the economic environment as well.
Right. Yeah, it's there's a lot in there. Obviously the last 2 years were unprecedented times. I think, you know, ShipBob grew over 100% CAGR for the last couple of years. But we still are very bullish on the e-commerce market. When you look at the U.S., it's still strong and forecasted to be strong in terms of growth rate. We still have very low penetration compared to other markets, particularly in Asia, if you compare where the U.S. is. There was a graph recently that circulated that did show the bump in spending in e-commerce is reverting back to the trend line, though, of where it was pre-pandemic. But I think even looking at that, we still think it's a great way for brands to launch. It's certainly lower cost than trying to go retail. What we're seeing with our merchants, though, is really going hybrid, where once they reach a certain level of success, they continue to sell on their own e-commerce website, but they are also now positioning or transitioning to retail. So they're wanting to partner with the large retailers, you know, names you can imagine. And the retailers also want those e-commerce brands in there.
So in a sense, a wholesale business or a store within a store type concept.
Yeah. Exactly. And so you're really seeing some of those more successful brands saying, yep, I have my .com address, but then I also am partnering with maybe a Target to give them, you know, unique products to draw consumers into their stores. But as you are seeing people return to retail, we are seeing more of our e-commerce brands pursuing retail as well. And so,
yeah, I think that makes sense to get increased distribution. Although, of course, their margins on that business are going to be a lot lower than their direct-to-consumer margins. So, you know, it's like, it makes sense and they want to build their brand and it's a great to have that distribution. But as a business, it's going to be a lot less profitable than their direct-to-consumer business naturally, just because of the margins they're able to command.
Absolutely. The margin, the inventory requirements, right? It is, you know, very different. But again, we're very bullish on e-commerce. We think just given what we've seen, the success of brands, that, you know, more brands will continue to be started, which is good for us, again, because we're serving merchants across the scale. We're really focused on those SMBs who need a partner to help them grow their business. And so new D2C company creation is one of the things that we continue to be very bullish on going forward.
Yeah, I think it's important. You know, you mentioned the trend line, and I just get so irritated when I read some of the conventional media stories and how they frame that. First of all, it's important to realize that e-commerce is still continuing to take market share away from physical retail, which is essentially flat. When you look at the inflation adjusted numbers, like traditional retail is essentially flat while e-commerce continues to grow. It's grown, a forecast to grow at about 9% annually this year, inflation adjusted. And that's on a $1 trillion number now. Like e-commerce is going to hit $1 trillion in the US market this year. So 9% growth on a $1 trillion number, that's nothing to be too snarky about. And at the same time, traditional retail is flat. So all these narratives about return to retail, no, that's kind of a false narrative. Yes, retail is always going to be there. It's always going to be important, and especially for certain customer segments, certain categories, certain kinds of shopping journeys, still very important. So by no means is this an either or, right? It's not a zero sum game between these channels. If anything, the channels do need to work together. But it's really a false narrative if you say, oh yeah, e-commerce is back to whatever, or now it's all about returning to store. That's a narrative that I think, frankly, some people with some skin in the game kind of want to push, and they tend to be media companies that relied on traditional advertisers. So,
e-commerce is formidable, right? I mean, there's you know, great brands out there, and there's a lot of innovation that's happening in the space. You know, we haven't talked about Amazon, but they're obviously continuing to innovate, and they serve a purpose as well as the D2C brands that ShipBob and others are servicing. So yeah, there's certainly a lot happening in the space, and you know, you also mentioned, you know, inflation and some of the economic challenges. So that's something we're certainly watching closely. We're continuing to see strong spend coming out of the merchants that we're working with, but that's, you know, obviously something we're watching just as some of the headlines get a little bit gloomier.
Yeah, another factor just to kind of highlight, you know, I think as you talk about, a lot of your customers do represent these newer digitally native direct-to-consumer brands. I think the pandemic was a period of time when those kind of brands had a unique opportunity. Consumers were very open to switching brands, trying new brands, trying new products. And of course, the barriers to entry are much different when everyone's on a level playing field in the digital domain. You have an opportunity as a small brand to still play ball next to much larger brands in a way where the playing field is evened out. And that brand loyalty that many larger organizations, larger businesses sort of relied on because they controlled shelf space, they controlled distribution, they controlled real estate, that was kind of gone in many respects. And so 75-80% of consumers tried new brands during the pandemic, and quite a few of them are going to stay that way, or their propensity to try new ones again are going to be quite high as well. Now, keep in mind that value shopping and generic brands and things like that are also seeing a bit of a resurgence right now due to the economic situation, but the consumer mindset changed significantly during the pandemic, and it's probably not going to revert back. And now the digital is our primary means again of discovering and shopping, that really levels the playing field for smaller brands, even in a tough environment, to grow significantly.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with those statements. And that's what we see with our merchant base, is just their ability to put something out that's unique to the market really does draw people to them. And consumers certainly are willing to try, and they're buying different types of products. You know, there's a huge focus on health, and there's a huge focus on beauty.
Sustainability.
Exactly that, you know, we're certainly seeing coming through the merchants who are joining our network.
Great stuff. Well, Brittany, it's time for our last question, which again is a standard question we ask every guest on the podcast. And that question is, what futuristic digital commerce innovation are you most looking forward to? Or alternatively, you're welcome to share something you feel is just overhyped and you wish people would stop talking about. So you can kind of go high or low with the question.
I'm going to go low.
Okay, good.
I'm fascinated to see what happens with drone to home delivery.
Oh, there we go. That's a good one.
I can't quite imagine the noise, the complexity of drones in my neighborhood trying to drop off packages, not hit the dog or the child or the person on the sidewalk. And
I would say I was one of those young teenage boys who would often be up to a little bit of mischief. And I can just imagine a lot of young teenage boys being like, nothing's more fun than trying to pick off the drone that's flying through the neighborhood. I'm sorry. I just can't imagine that that wouldn't happen.
Exactly. Or a colleague once showed me, it was like almost like a cooler on wheels delivering her daughter's sandwich at college. And it's like, well, who's just going to run over, open that up and steal the sandwich or something? I don't know. So these autonomous, you know, small vehicles, drones, coolers on wheels, delivering goods to consumers. I just am fascinated by it and how it will actually get commercialized. So
I love it. I love it. I think that's such a good call out. I think that in a controlled environment, like a college campus, I can actually kind of see the cooler on wheel thing working and a lot of lazy kids in their dorms not wanting to walk, you know,
a couple hundred yards to the cafeteria.
I think the drone thing, I think there's so many great applications for it. And I think there absolutely will be, like, it will happen to some degree. I'm just not sure about, to your point, the backyard consumer delivery.
Right. In an urban environment, right? Maybe not an urban environment. Maybe in, you know, more rural areas, you know, that could somehow reduce last mile costs. But yeah, I mean, living close to downtown Chicago, it seems far-fetched.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you. And, you know, there are some really important ways in which that will happen too. Like, you know, they're already using it in remote areas to do everything from fast autonomous delivery of pharmaceuticals or even like transplants and things like this. And so it's like, what a great tool. But is that going to scale to residential delivery? I think you're asking a very good question. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, this is great, Brian.
Well, Brittany, thanks again for taking the time with us here today. And to all of our listeners out there, please check the show notes for links on where you can connect with Brittany and Ship Bob. And in the meantime, be safe, be well, and here's to good business.